You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stephen Gates, a food science writer, broadcaster, and gastronaut. Now, the majority of food waste, 71% of it, happens in our homes. We all know that it's a huge environmental issue. The greenhouse gas emissions from food waste in the UK are equivalent to 10 million cars. And yet, despite 4 out of 5 of us saying that we care about the environment, we're just not changing our behaviour. So what can be done to nudge us into reducing food waste? Well, with me to discuss this are David Hall, the founder and executive director of Behaviour Change. Hello, David.
Hello.
And Tessa Clark, who's the co-founder and CEO of Olio, an app which enables people to share food rather than waste it. Hi, Tessa.
Hi.
Now, David, let's just start off with you. Give me a brief overview of what behavioural economics is and what it can be used for.
At the end of the day, it's about understanding how people tick and therefore how we can change their behaviour. There's lots of different terms you might have heard. People talk about behavioural science, behavioural economics. I mean, I prefer just the term behaviour change, because that's ultimately what we're interested in doing. And I think the term science perhaps implies that we have a deeper scientific understanding of really how to change behavior than perhaps we actually do. What it comes down to from my perspective is our understanding of how people make decisions. And I guess, you know, the big spoiler there is most people's decisions aren't terribly rational. We make decisions for a whole load of reasons, yeah. Kind of habit, context, you know, what's something that we call noise, which is the kind of extraneous factors that influence what we do. And behavior change seeks to firstly kind of understand those influences, tools that can help us enable people to make better decisions. And you've probably heard about nudging and social norms and various behavioral tools that we can use to try and get people to behave in ways that are more positive and helpful to them.
And now you work in sustainability now, but back in the day you were in advertising, weren't you? And you had to come up with a strategy for changing the image of Skoda cars from being the butt of jokes to being a respectable brand. I mean, is it useful to use those same techniques you learned in advertising to change our attitude to food waste?
I suppose, you know, I've certainly gained a lot of knowledge since those days of trying to influence people's buying behavior. But I think there are some interesting learnings even from the work that I did back then. I think the first one is probably around the gap between perception and reality. So what was interesting in Skoda's case, I mean, perhaps not in the case of the car that you and your parents had, but you know, by the time I was working on it, Skoda's cars had completely transformed, but perceptions of them hadn't. It was basically a VW that was 10 grand cheaper, but actually people still had this kind of old view of what Skodas were like. And I think there's often a great opportunity for behavior change when there's a gap between what people think and what they actually do, or the reality of the situation. So, you know, food waste is quite an interesting case in point there, because I think most people think that they don't waste food. If you kind of ask people how much food they waste, they'll say, oh, no, I'm very, you know, maybe once in a while I'll sort of stick some peelings in the food waste bin. But other than that, I never waste food. The reality is, once you get people to kind of really look at what they waste, most people waste quite a lot of food. So if you can begin to bridge that gap, if you begin to get people to understand what they actually do, then you're on the way to changing people's behavior. But I think the other thing, the thing that advertising tends to do is it starts with attitudes. So kind of we think if only we can change people's attitude, then their behavior will follow. Or even if only we can sort of raise awareness, get them to know about something, their behavior will follow. And I think the learning from behavior change is that's not necessarily true. So if you look at Five a Day, for example, kind of famous food campaign encouraging us all to eat more fruit and veg, we all know that we should eat 5 fruit and veg a day, but the vast majority of us don't do it. So, you know, the real challenge for behavior change is how we move on from just changing people's attitudes and building their knowledge to actually thinking about tools that can actually get people to do something different.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, this is a problem throughout food and nutrition. It's, you know, it's like teaching kids to eat better. You know, say to kids that that's bad and that's good, eat that one. That is tantamount to heresy. You know, you might as well be dead in a child's eyes when you say a plate of chips is bad. Okay, now Tessa, many people will have heard of Olio, but can you explain how the app works and why it's important?
Yeah, so Olio exists to tackle the problem of food waste specifically in the home. And you just mentioned earlier on the quite sort of surprising statistic for many people that sort of post-farm gate, roughly 3/4 of all food waste takes place in the home. Most people assume that most food waste takes place at a retail store level. And that just couldn't be further from the truth. And the reason for that is because typical British family throws away roughly 20% of the weekly shop. And that, which is worth over £700 sterling per year, and it collectively adds up to a massive £14 billion. So we've got sort of 28 million households doing that.
It's not just shocking; it's also a tragedy, isn't it? I mean, on so many different levels.
Yes, on every level, it's environmentally devastating. It's socially wrong. It's morally wrong. There's a lot of people who are struggling to put food on the table. No matter which way you look at it, it just should not exist. But we do have this massive sort of perception gap, because most people, when you talk about food waste, they think it's something that takes place at a supermarket level. And actually, the supermarkets are only responsible for a couple of percentage points of all food waste. And the reason for that is, you know, it's just a numbers game. There's about 10 or 15,000 supermarkets that throw away about half a percentage point, in contrast to 28 million households throwing away roughly 20% in the weekly shop. And I think a lot of people, it's sort of, they might be about to throw away 2 brown bananas and they think, well, what difference does that make? It's only me. But actually, there's another, you know, millions and millions and millions of people doing that sort of same equation. And so that is why we in our homes are we are the largest contributor to food waste. And Olio exists to tackle that, because what we've discovered is that nobody likes throwing away food. You'd be hard pushed to find someone who says, I love throwing away food. But what we've found is that people throw away food because they don't have anyone to give that food to. So there's all sorts of reasons about why they have surplus food, right? You know, you sort of over cater for an event, you're working late, change of plans, you buy too much, unwanted food gifts. That explains why you have surplus food. But the reason why it becomes waste is none of those reasons. It's because we're no longer connected to our local community. We no longer have someone to give that food to. And Olio solves that problem by providing a fun, easy and safe way to connect you with your neighbours so that you can give away that food rather than throw it away. And how it works is really simple. It takes about 10 seconds to add some food to the app. You just snap a photo and upload it. Neighbours living nearby get an alert, letting them know that something new has been added near them. They can then browse the listings, request what they want, and pop round and pick it up.
So it's pretty simple. Now, this is not a plug for you at all. I'm not being paid by Olio in any way, but we have used it. We run a studio here in my house, and my wife's a food photographer. So we do occasionally get weird amounts of food. Like, I think we had 40 litres of yogurt at some point. And which, of course, you just
it's
can't
a bit much
with.
For one household,
yeah,
isn't it?
And you can't freeze it. You know, it's impossible to really deal with it. And so we used Olio, and lots of people came around, and there was a lot of yogurt around Newington Green. So it works. It seems to work really well. But how successful has it been on a business level?
Yeah. So we'll touch on sort of our impact first, and then I'll kind of talk about the business. So Olio started as a pilot in 5 postcodes in North London just over 5 years ago. And as of today, we've had over 3.5 million people join us. Roughly 3/4 of those are in the UK and 1/4 outside of the UK. And our community has collectively shared 18 million portions of food. And that has had an environmental impact equivalent to taking 52 million car miles off the road, which I recently discovered is equivalent to driving all the way to Mars and halfway back. And we've also, as a result of our food sharing, have saved 2.6 billion litres of water, because people might not realise this, but food production is incredibly, incredibly water intensive. So we've had an enormous impact. What's really exciting is that's about 0.01% of our full potential, right? If you think, you know, we've still got a tiny number of people, relatively speaking, using Olio. And then in terms of the business, we generate revenues, and we do that through our Food Waste Heroes program. So that is a scheme that we have developed whereby we recruit and train volunteers via the app, and we connect them with their local business, which might be a supermarket or a bakery or deli, corporate canteen, perhaps a photo shoot. And those volunteers will, at their allotted time and date, pop out of their home across the road. They will go pick up all of the unsold food. They take it home. They add it to the app. Within minutes, the neighbors will request it. Minutes later, it's been picked up. And so that's taken that food from having been considered a waste stream at that business location just 1 to 2 hours later to instead being fully redistributed into the homes of the local community. And at the moment, businesses pay waste contractors to take that food off to landfill or at best anaerobic digestion. And now they are paying us to ensure that that food is redistributed and eaten by the local community. And then we've very recently introduced the concept of an Olio supporter in the app. So you can support Olio's mission by a monthly or annual subscription, and you get to unlock some additional features.
Mm-hmm. So it's, I guess this is a I mean, I'm not sure it's a form of nudging people towards it. It's giving people tools to be able to solve the problem. And that, it seems to be fundamental to a problem such as food waste. Would you say that people are encouraged by supermarkets to overbuy food? It's the classic, the bog-off offers, the special offers across the board. Yeah. I mean, are supermarkets partly culpable for this?
So I think it really comes back to our human instincts and thinking about understanding how we evolved. Food is our life source, right? It is therefore very, very instinctive to want to surround ourselves with plenty of food. And our cultures have evolved to have food at the very heart of it. So yes, I think it's a combination of our instincts combined with capitalism, which encourage us to play to those instincts and to buy an awful lot, result combined with our very unpredictable lives, means that we end up having more food than we need. A lot of the supermarkets have actually been doing quite a bit of work to try and move away from that discounting of food, because that has been widely recognized as a problem for people. And in particular, let's say things like bags of salad. You know, people get, oh, I'll get three instead of two. And before you know it, you've got a pile of mush at the bottom of your veg drawer. So the supermarkets recognize that they do have a role to play, yes, in people's purchasing habits. There's also a role, I think, that we all have to play around better educating people around what dates mean. So there's widespread confusion around the various dates. So here in the UK, we have broadly two dates, use by dates and best before dates. And a use by date is the health and safety date. So you shouldn't theoretically eat food after that date. But the best before date just means it's optimal for consumption prior to that date. But it's perfectly safe and delicious to eat for weeks, months, even years after that date. But a lot of people get very confused by the two. And the minute they see that something's gone past its best before date, they're sort of throwing it away. So
I'm digging things out of the compost bin. And
me too. I mean, I would dearly love to get rid of best before dates, to be perfectly honest, because of the confusion that they do create for people.
Okay. Now, David, so Olio is giving people some tools to begin to start to make a change. How do you advise people to go about this? Because it's one of these intractable issues, isn't it? It always brings me back to this concept of telling kids to eat better. They just that's not the way to achieve it. How would you suggest people start to go about this issue, solving this issue?
I mean, there are fundamentally two ways to change behavior. So one of them is to make it easier for people to do the thing that you want them to do. And the other is to put them under pressure. And, you know, I think what's so great about Olio is essentially it does the former. I mean, the best ways of changing behavior are ways which, you know, solve a problem for someone, that make it easier for them to do the thing that you want them to do. And ideally, if it's easier to not waste food than it is to waste food, then we're onto something. And so I think, you know, as far as possible, when we're thinking about changing behavior, we're looking for strategies that can make it easier for people to do the thing that we want them to do. I think, the second area, putting people under pressure, is a bit broader. So, you know, obviously telling somebody to do something, you know, ordering your kids to eat their vegetables is a form of pressure. That can work, but it doesn't always work terribly well.
Might work with your kids.
but you know, fundamentally, there are three ways you can put people under pressure. You can incentivize them to do something. You know, so we know with our kids, we kind of, if you eat all your veg, I remember my mum once said to me when I was a child, if you eat all those peas, I'll go out to the garden and I'll pick you a strawberry for each pea that you eat. She hadn't quite calculated how many peas there were on my plate. So sort of 40 peas later, the entire strawberry bush in the garden was sort of destroyed for my pudding. But, you know, these incentives are definitely one way to get people to do something, but they're problematic, you know, as that idea shows, because actually if you get people kind of hooked on the idea of an incentive, they're probably not going to do it without one. You can obviously
you're trapped in the incentive. Yeah.
Exactly. You can create penalties. So that's typically what, you know, government do. We tax people, we fine people, we punish people if they do the wrong thing. And, you know, in the case of coronavirus, that's kind of, we've lived in a kind of world of penalties, which we know are effective to an extent, but perhaps not in entirely. But then you can also sort of create persuasive arguments. You can kind of give people compelling reasons why they should do something. And, you know, I guess where behavior change is quite interesting on that front is we know that things like social norms are more powerful than traditional kind of forms of persuasion. So social norms, for instance, is about saying, you know, this is what other people do. People don't like being in the minority. So people don't like, you know, recycling is a great example. Once recycling gets to a certain level, once everyone in your street is recycling, or virtually everyone in your street, you don't want to be the one who's left out. You don't want to be the one who's not doing the right thing. And therefore, you know, those kinds of tools can be very useful for putting people under pressure. But I guess
it's also dangerous as well, isn't it? I mean, there was at one point, it's not quite about the food issue, but at one point there was somebody who was fined for putting recyclable material into the black bin, and there was a bit of an outcry about it. Now, I guess you could charge people for the amount of food that they're wasting. It's very difficult to do, because how do you actually measure that? But do you think penalties is that part of nudging, or is that actually anathema to you? I can see you almost curling your lip at the idea of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we prefer positive routes, and we're not super comfortable with penalties. I do think, you know, penalties, as you say, they can be very difficult to implement. And food waste is one of those things. It's kind of quite private. You might not even, you know, that different members of the family potentially have different approaches and different things that they're doing. So, you know, really policing that is very difficult. I do think, you know, there's some interesting learnings from recycling, where there's a large group of the population who are kind of influenceable through kind of soft measures. And then there are always probably going to be a small group of people who are literally, unless you kind of force them to do something, they're probably not going to do it. But I think in the case of food and food waste, there's a lot of headroom still. You know, there's a lot of progress that we can make through kind of positive encouragement and kind of helping people to do the right thing, rather than kind of punishing them and telling them off.
Yeah. So you've got some other practical suggestions for how to achieve this.
I mean, I think the other thing I would say is focus on the behaviours themselves. So I think food waste is a complex area, you know. And as Tessa said, there's all sorts of things that are kind of going into at the front end. You know, there's the amount of food we buy, there's the occasions we're buying them for, there's the type of foods that we're buying, and we know that there are particular foods that tend to get wasted more often. I think I'm right in saying potatoes is kind of number one in terms of weight, which is perhaps not surprising, but, you know, things like chicken and bread, and actually even kind of fizzy drinks are things that get wasted quite a lot. So kind of focusing in on the behaviors, understanding exactly what is going on in those particular cases. You know, why are people wasting potatoes? Is it because, you know, when you make mash, there's that weird thing that happens where the amount of mash that looks right on the plate and the amount of potato that you would actually ever eat in any other circumstances, there's a kind of weird gap there, isn't there? So
plus the extra pack of butter.
Yeah. So there's some sort of strange things that go on that if we understand them, we can begin to tackle them. So that would always be my start point. And I think, exactly as Tessa says, nobody sets out to waste food. Nobody wants to waste food. And therefore, there's a series of kind of decision points that lead up to the moment of food being wasted. And even at the final moment, you can potentially, you know, you can go onto Olio, you can put it in the freezer, you can do something else with it. And so there are lots of opportunities to kind of save your food and kind of change the trajectory of that product so that it doesn't go to waste. And I think, you know, ultimately tackling food waste from a behavior change perspective is about understanding all those moments, understanding the decisions that go into those moments, and then creating strategies, whether they're, you know, things to make it easier for people to do the thing we want to do, or things that put them under pressure to do it, that can then tackle those problems. I think the only sort of challenge with all of that is you end up potentially kind of salami slicing the problem into so many little mini, you know, so we identify, you know, best before dates as a problem. We identify people changing their plans and going out, and instead, although nobody's doing that at the moment, but that will be happening again soon. And you end up with so many mini problems that you probably don't have the kind of capacity to generate all the solutions that you need. And I think that in a way, that's the challenge. And as you know, as we said earlier, we're up against the forces of capitalism in terms of people who are very good at kind of encouraging people to buy more and try new things and so on. So actually, sort of the extent to which in our little kind of not-for-profit way, we might be able to tackle all of those things, I think is one of the real challenges with food waste, because it's not a singular one hit silver bullet type issue.
I would agree with that, David. And if I had to sort of step back and select the sort of master umbrella thing that we need to achieve, it's about making food waste become socially unacceptable. Because I can remember when we worked together, David, going kind of deep diving onto the various things that drive consumer behavior change. And unfortunately, one of the biggest, most effective things of driving consumer behavior change is when people believe that everyone else is doing something. So with food waste, we're in this very sort of bizarre kind of chicken and egg situation, which is how can we persuade everybody to think that everybody else now agrees that wasting food is unacceptable? And so there's definitely just that sort of cultural narrative that has to shift. And actually, COVID was incredibly powerful. So there was quite a bit of data that came out which showed a step change in terms of how people viewed food and how they valued food. And therefore, there was a corresponding reduction in food waste.
Do we know how much the reduction was?
Well, so I can remember that there was some data that came out by Hubbub, and I seem to recall that it said that over 50% of people were both valuing food more and wasting food less. Then when the first lockdown finished, there was a reduction in, there was an increase in food waste again, but it still, I believe, has not got back to pre-pandemic levels. So it was a pretty substantial change. And that sort of concept of what other people are doing is something that we, through Olio, have really leaned quite heavily on, because a lot of people look at Olio and their first thought is, oh gosh, who on earth would pick up this food? Because often they themselves wouldn't necessarily bother to go pick up a head of broccoli or two lemons or three out of date tins of soup. But ironically, that's not our challenge at all. Half of all the food added to the app is requested within 21 minutes nowadays. So the demand is off the charts for free spare food from a neighbor. Our much bigger challenge is getting that behavioral change around giving something away, bothering to give something away. And so we have put lots of social proof now through the user journey. So when you join Olio, we show you how many other people are near you. On the listings, there's a little eyeball that shows you how many people have viewed that. And there are just multiple places where we're trying to reinforce that this is what people do nowadays, because that seems to be the most effective trigger in getting people to change their behavior.
Now, is the UK particularly bad at food waste? How do we rate compared to other comparable nations?
I don't have the exact data to hand, but I know that sort of Europe and the US were all much of a muchness, pretty terrible. My understanding is that the UK has made great strides relatively globally in terms of driving food waste reduction over the past sort of 10 or 15 years, although that has plateaued recently. So there was a big decline. I think we improved it by 20 or 25%, but now it has plateaued. And clearly it's a massive problem because we're chucking £14 billion worth of perfectly good food into the bin each year, and it's over £700 per family.
And it's interesting that money is not more of a driver, really, isn't it? I think that's always so fascinating.
Now, it is. I think it's because it's the cumulative effect of lots of small actions. So it's not like there's one moment in time where you are chucking £700 into the bin, because I think people would stop that immediately. But it's 50p here, 25p there, maybe a pound somewhere else.
Yeah, it's incremental, and that's part of the problem, I guess. Now, do you think that we're thinking big enough here in the UK? I mean, is the problem individual households? Do we need a bigger issue? You know, do we need a bit of dream scenario here? Do we need to go back to state-run British restaurants, bigger shared meals? I mean, are there other fundamentals that we should be tackling here? David, what do you think? Should we be tackling these incremental little solutions, one lemon at a time?
Yeah, I mean, just very quickly going back to the UK point, I think the UK is particularly good at measuring our food waste. So there's a brilliant organization called RAP that you may well have come across who have done a lot of work in this space, actually, to the extent of kind of going through people's bins. You know, the reason we have such granular understanding of people's food waste is there's literally a program that, you know, they don't just know how many slices of bread have been thrown away in the kind of sample households. They know how many of them were toasted, you know, and how many of them were kind of burnt and therefore thrown away for that reason. So, you know, we do, you know, and sadly, you know, government cuts and so on, the data that we're gathering now, I think, isn't quite as good as it was a few years ago. But we do have a brilliant understanding of what's going on here. And perhaps that does slightly lead us down that route of getting very specific because we know the specifics. But I think you're absolutely right that there are probably some bigger thinking required. I mean, to Tessa's point, I do think the social norms side of it is very important, and turning it into something which is, you know, kind of occupies a different role in people's perception of what others do is very important. But I think I think often when we try to create kind of movements, if you like, that try to make something, I think, make something socially unacceptable, for example, those often fail. And I think if you look at kind of things that aren't bottom up, things that have been a kind of an attempt to impose some kind of change like that from above, they tend not to work very well. So I think, you know, plastic was a good example of an issue that somehow bubbled up. There were various things that happened. Obviously, there was David Attenborough and his documentaries, but there were various other things going on at the time, all of which came together, and it became an issue of genuine public concern. And I think that was something, I mean, debatable how much impact it's actually had on behavior. That's something that you couldn't have manufactured. And I think one of the problems is the moment you try and sort of manufacture a kind of public concern or movement about something, it generally doesn't work very well. So
many of those campaigns have always felt like money being poured down the drain. I mean, five a day, even things like the salt campaign, noble issues dealt with in such wasteful ways, I thought.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the other thing I would say is, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, this is about an entire system. So, you know, food waste is a symptom of, you know, how we cook and eat and consume and buy food. And it's ultimately there's lots of elements to that potentially need to change. So I think, you know, how and where we buy food obviously has a huge impact. Kind of how we cook, how we eat, the kitchens that we cook things in, what kind of bins we have, you know, all those things make a difference. So I think if you want to tackle even on a salami slice kind of level. If you want to tackle those things, you have to look at them from the broadest possible perspective. And I think, you know, there is a challenge, you know, overall, I think in the food system, there's a challenge around how we balance kind of convenience and kind of ethics, I suppose, if you like. So you know, the supermarkets have been brilliant at making it incredibly convenient for us to eat the things that we like. You know, we can get everything from around the world, whatever we want. We can get things packaged up, chopped for us. Everything's there for us, ready. And therefore, you know, we've got used to things being convenient, and we don't necessarily need the skills to do things differently. But so often, I think campaigners think, well, the way we're going to tackle this problem is by going back to kind of less convenient but more sort of meaningful ways of doing things. You know, spending longer. You know, sitting around a table rather than sort of eating food in their cars, which apparently in America is now the most common place to eat a meal. You know, and I think there's a real tension there between, are we trying to, you know, do we need to tackle food waste by making it incredibly convenient for people not to waste food in the way that we've changed people's diets in all sorts of other ways? Or do we need to go back to some other, you know, sort of more sort of meaningful and satisfying ways of eating and living? And I think that tension is something that I don't feel that we've quite resolved. And I'm not sure the answer lies on one side or the other. But only by thinking about those big issues around diet and food, I think, can we really get to the bottom of solving food waste.
Yeah. Now, Tessa, is there a level of food waste that is acceptable or that is sustainable, or is there a percentage number, or is that basically irrelevant? Is it a set of attitudes that need to happen?
I do think that we have got to aim to get as close to sort of, you know, 5% or less of food waste. If you look at any company, for example, then they would consider less than 5% wastage as acceptable and reasonable. We are in a situation where globally we're wasting between a third and a half of all the food we produce. So clearly we have such a long way to go. What I would love to see, I think every player has a role to play, but what I'd like to see government do in particular is really focus in schools, because at the moment, too many people don't value food. And if you don't value something, then why would you bother not wasting it, right? And so I would love to see many, many, many more kids getting direct experience in schools of growing things themselves. You know, the minute you have grown your first carrot, you think about a carrot very, very differently. And so I think there's a lot to do with around education of how food is grown, how to cook and store and prepare food, and also the environmental impact of food waste. And a piece of work came out last year from Project Drawdown, which Stack ranks the top 100 solutions to the climate crisis. And it's a collaborative piece of work by several hundred of the world's leading climate crisis scientists. And in position number one was reducing food waste. That's the most powerful lever we have to pull against the climate crisis. And it came above electric cars, above solar power, and above a plant-based diet. And kids are being taught increasingly about the climate crisis in school. And I think food waste needs to be put sort of front and central in that curriculum. I think I would love to see best before dates abolished, because that then, rather than us just sort of unthinkingly seeing a date and lobbing it in the bin, it would then force us to pause and think. And the minute you start thinking and engaging in something, you're likely to have sort of a slightly different outcome. And then, you know, I think Olio has a massive role to play in this. We are constantly, back to sort of David's point of trying to make not wasting food feel as convenient as wasting food. People ask us who our competitor is, and we say our competitor is the rubbish bin. It's not another app, it is the bin. And we have got to provide an experience that is as close to the bin as possible as being convenient. But much more importantly, it gives you a lot of other great stuff. It gives you social connection. It gives you a sense of belonging. It gives you a sense of empowerment, that you're making a difference. We give people their impact data back. And I think all of that sort of softer stuff has a really, really important role to play, that it actually feels enjoyable to not waste food. Yeah. And if we can achieve that, then I think that will really drive behavior change.
Okay. So final question for both of you. Starting off with you, Tessa. Now, what one thing should people do to make the most immediate difference in reducing food waste?
I have a framework, which is my five S's as to how to reduce food waste. And the very first one of those, which I think is the most important one, is to shop with a plan. Mm-hmm. If you just once a week sit down, plan your weekly meals, shop to that plan, and I would always have one meal be a cupboard meal. And so what that means is that if your plans change, you're not going to be wasting a day's worth of fresh food because it was just that cupboard meal that you sacrificed. Yeah. That would be the number one S. Very quickly, if I can be cheeky, my other ones is to learn how to store food properly. Mm. There are hundreds of tips and tricks online, which are really quite fun as to how to store food. Next S is serving the right portion size. Simple trick here is just to use smaller plates. Yeah. And you will immediately waste less food. The fourth S is to save your leftovers. Mm-hmm. People are often surprised when they try that to realize that, gosh, it tastes so much better two or three nights later because it's had the opportunity to kind of marinate. Yeah. And then the final S is to share your spare with a neighbor.
Yeah. Use Olio, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, David, what's your tip? What's the one thing that you think would make the biggest, shortest term difference to reducing food waste?
And I'm probably less well qualified than Tessa to answer this question. But I suppose from my perspective, it's all about understanding more about why people do it. So I think if we could have better, deeper research into, you know, how and why people are wasting food at the moment, I think that's going to give us a better chance of changing that behavior. And I think, you know, we know a lot about what people waste. You know, as I was saying earlier, that the kind of slices of toast in bins, we don't really know all that much about why. And I think a deeper understanding of why people waste food would be really interesting. I've got a little theory about super wasters. So I suspect, you know, I think there are people out there who are sort of incapable of planning anything, let alone a shopping list, or, you know, cooking from the cupboard. And, you know, and I suspect those people are responsible for really quite a large amount of food waste. And I think it'd be really interesting to kind of focus in who are the people who are wasting the most food and are the furthest away from the kind of skills that Tess is talking about. And how could we really understand what's going on there? Tackle, you know, and work with those individuals kind of to develop a way that we could help them waste less food. And if we could do that with them, I suspect we could do it with anyone. So, you know, understand really what's going on and then work with the biggest wasters to think about ways that they can reduce their food waste.
And it's absolutely true. I think, you know, stage one of solving a problem like this is measuring it and understanding it. And then that often leads you to some of the solutions. Well, Tessa Clark and David Hall, thank you so much for joining us today. I feel energized about the changes we could all make. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from stopping hunger to nutritional supplements for gamers. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks so much for listening.